Okay. Last evening we saw this whole series of talks is about the primary work of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, which is to help all of humanity take the next step in evolution. And the next step in evolution is to have built the soul body so that we can function in that as clearly as we function in this body, because this world and this body are for a time going to be disappearing, going to be dissolved back into the inner realms. And so preparing people, preparing ourselves, that is the primary work that we do. What we did yesterday is generally introduce the whole idea, and we tried to put it in a large cosmic perspective. In this talk, what we're going to do is we're going to look at very briefly, extremely briefly, the nature of the etheric subdivision of the physical world. We're going to get some of the basic ideas about that realm so that we know what we're working with. And then for the next two talks, we're going to be extremely practical and talk about everyday things for building the soul body, and toward the end we'll talk about using it a little bit. Some of this information is from Max Heindel and the Rosicrucian literature, and some of it is conjecture and inference from studying it and studying reality and trying to make sense out of it. Now, things that are strictly from the Rosicrucian philosophy, I will try to mention that, and what is inference, I'll try to mention that that is that. So the soul body, here they come. Yes, it's been going on.
13 squad cars.
Oh, what?
What's sad is you had time to count them. Which meant you were sitting there.
So the soul body, which is the objective of these talks, is only part of the vital body. But we want to be sure that we understand all of the ethers and all of the vital body so that we can see some very crucial things about the relationship of the soul body to the rest of the vital body, and if we have the basic information, it will come much clearer. The adepts, or the seers of the Rosicrucian order, find that there are four ethers. And naming them from the grossest to the most rare, they are the chemical ether, the life ether, the light ether, and the reflecting ether. Now, when things are given names in the Rosicrucian philosophy, they're usually given names according to their function. The desire body is called the desire body because that is its primary function at this time in evolution, to give motivation or desire so that we move our vital and physical bodies. The names for the reflecting ethers are not an exception to this. The names for the reflecting ethers are named according to their usage. Now, what we said yesterday is that all of the ethers, the four ethers, together with the solids, liquids, and gases, are all part of the same physical world. And for the most part, there are some laws that affect every part of the physical world. The most commonly cited example for showing that the ethers are subject to the laws of the physical world is the relationship of gravity. And that is to say that the ethers are subject to gravity. This has been a big thing in science. It was predicted by Einstein in 1915 that even light would be affected by gravity. And then in the eclipse of 1919, Arthur Eddington, the British astronomer, set up the experiment during an eclipse to show that, yes, light is indeed affected by gravity. But as rare as the light ether is, which is the medium on which light is born, even the reflecting ether is subject to gravity. That is also an example that's cited by Max Heindel. He said this is the reason, one of the reasons why people who want to live highly contemplative lives live at high altitude, because the reflecting ether is the basis for some etheric thought forms. And it's actually true that some of the grosser thought forms are more subject to gravity than some of the lighter ones. And therefore, if you're on a mountaintop or someplace like that, you're less likely to be bothered by the heavy or dark thought forms in the etheric atmosphere. And some people have done just the opposite to Plato. In the true Western spirit, put his academy right on the edge of the swamp because it was supposed to be unhealthy and because there would be these kinds of influences, because he wanted to swim upstream and he wanted his students to be students that were building moral muscle, as Heindel would call it, by taking on adversity. Now, the fact that the ethers are part of the physical world helps us, because we can understand by analogy from the things that we experience in the solids, liquids, and gases, we can understand some of the things, not all, we can understand some of the things about the ethers from our experience here. For example, there are analogous interactions between the ethers, just like there are actions between the solids, liquids, and gases. Now, for example, some things apply and some things don't apply. The liquids and gases are all subject to the laws of fluid dynamics, and they work according to them. However, the Boyle's law, which applies to the gases, does not apply to the liquids. So some things apply and some things do not. Now, light, which is carried through the light ether, leaves impressions on the negative pole of the reflecting ether. That is, the images that we see in the negative pole of the reflecting ether are brought there by light. But the light ether itself is not connected to the world of thought. There is not that direct link between the world of thought and the reflecting ether that there is between, the light ether doesn't have that. All right. Now, there are some characteristics of ethers that are not at all found in the solids, liquids, and gases, and they happen to be very important things for understanding the basic nature of the ethers. Now, there are changes of state that we see all the time. For example, at a specific temperature and specific pressure, we have the latent heat of fusion, which when applied takes a solid water, ice, and turns it into liquid water. And under similar conditions, the right temperature and the right pressure, the liquid water becomes gaseous steam. So This is an indication that there is a change of state between solids, liquids, and gases, but it shows something else. It shows that a formation or a compound can go through all of the states. It's still water, whether it's gaseous water, whether it is liquid water, or whether it is ice. Now, the same thing happens in the ethers. It's important that the different states of existence between the different solids, liquids, gases, and the four ethers, they're independent states, but you can carry a form all the way through them. This is the way the physical body, made out of solids, liquids, and gases, is condensed, so to speak, out of the ethers. And the form stays in the ethers even after they have been removed from the dense physical air, or the etheric form stays in it. And the best example of that is frost flowers. If you have a room like this with plants in, and it gets very cold, as it does here in the winter, frost forms on the windows, and it forms all kinds of crystalline patterns. And if you look very carefully at those patterns, you'll see that the patterns are like the leaves of the plant that are in the room. This means to say that the form that has been part of the solid plant and that went with the steam when it left the physical, when it left the plant itself, when that steam or that vaporous water is condensed as ice on the window, the etheric form is still with it. It is carried all the way from the solid state through the gaseous state, and it's still forming it when it's brought back down again and frozen into an ice state. So there are all kinds of experiments like that that have shown this and has proven it. I've got a whole book about snowflakes and frost flowers up in the attic. It's really quite interesting that you can make that, you can reproduce any kind of leaves that you want by doing that. The same phenomena then is in all of the different states. So what we're trying to talk about is that there are two things. There are the states of existence, the seven states of physical existence, and the formations that pass through those states. And all of the states of matter in the physical plane are vehicles for forms which come from yet higher levels of existence to become manifest. And these are things, you know, this is the way the world that we live in works. Now, the ethers are very different in that they're even more fluidic than the gases and liquids are. They're very, very difficult to get a handle on. And they are transitional. They are transitional between the higher spiritual worlds, the higher spiritual bodies, and this world that we understand and know and experience from our senses. And in that transitional state, they have characteristics both of the fluidic higher realms and the more static lower realms. This is something that is found by physics. Physics is dealing with the same world that we are. Unfortunately, the way they deal with the world is much more awkwardly because they put their effort into mechanical devices and deducing from things from the five senses rather than taking a lot of time and developing the etheric vision so that they could see and things would be a lot simpler. But it is one of the things that physics finds is that light or electrons or things like that, with the names that they give to states in the ethers, can be seen both as a wave and as a particle. It has the property of both. And this is one of the characteristics of the ethers. They are transitional between the purely live spiritual worlds, inner worlds, and the relatively dead external world. Now, we're not trying, when we say things like this, we're not trying to prove mystical science by physical science. That would be a big mistake. That would be trying to use something lesser to prove something greater. But just to show that by either means of investigation, materialistic science, or by spiritual science, the same nature of the reality is there. It's just that with physical science, it's very, very awkward. In fact, one of the very best physicists in this field of looking at atoms and atomic particles and things like that, Feynman, Nobel Prize winner, very brilliant man, said, yes, we can predict the movement of an electron with a certain probability, but he says the amount of computer time that we have to do and the number of calculations we have to go through to do that is enormous. He says that leads me to believe that there's something indirect or something awkward about the way that we understand reality. It's very much like what Jalal ad-Din Rumi said about the elephant. Rumi was a mystic, a Persian mystic, with wonderful insight, and he had a lot of teaching stories, and one of them was how some men tried to raise funds by bringing people the experience of an elephant who had never seen an elephant and had never seen a picture of an elephant. And they brought it in at night when nobody could, when nobody was awake to see it, and they kept it in a dark tent. And they charged admission to go in to see the elephant. And one man went in, he came out, and he said, the elephant is like giant fans. And another went in, and he came out, and he said, no, he had it all wrong. The elephant is like giant pillars. And yet another one went in and came out and he said, they both have it wrong. The elephant is like a big horse. And and what the little teaching story ends, how different it would have been if they had a little light and could see the whole reality. He used it, as Sufis usually do, to show the uniformity of all religions, and that if you really had a little bit of enlightenment, you could see that they were really all one. And that's the kind of thing, relative to the very awkward ways of materialistic science, that indicates that same kind of thing.
Richard?
Yes?
What century was Rumi?
I think 14th. All of these things, talking about, oh, I forgot to get the picture, and let me see if I can find it.
I think that's just a problem. So
in some places in Rosicrucian literature, the etheric atoms are described as prisms, that they're prismatic in shape. Plato, who was a geometrician, said they all look like triangles. This is a very particulate way of looking at it. In other places, Max Heindel says that the etheric atom looks very much like a wastebasket, one of those wire wastebaskets that looks like the paths of orbits This is a picture. This is a book called Principles of Light and Color. It was published by, and this is a modern edition, which is not good at all compared to the original. This was written by a clairvoyant in the time of Max Heindel, and the very first edition of this book was edited by Max Heindel. He did it as a favor to the author, and this is a picture, I'll just pass it around, of what the etheric atom looks like to the clairvoyant eye. It's actually the whole caduceus of Mercury. It's actually, you know, it's got the whole path of evolution built right into it. So we say, find the same thing there, that in some ways, etheric atoms seem to be like geometric shapes, or if you apperceive them in a static sense, they seem like solid things. This room is sufficiently dark enough that if you look into some of the back corners, within the darkness, you can see that the light is cobwebbed right in the darkness. In a semi-darkened room, if you look to where the corners all come together, where the three dimensions come together, that does something to your consciousness, that you begin to focus through the optic nerve. And as you do that, you begin to see in the ethers, and you see that there are little rainbows, filaments of light, but at connecting points that are like little rainbows. It's like cobweb with rainbows. And that's the beginning of the etheric vision if you're seeing it in a particulate way. You can also see it as something very, very fluidic. That picture is very fluidic, and it is then both wave and particle. I don't want to dwell too long on this because science has dwelt so long on it that it's a dead topic. Boy, these are hard ones to read. There are some philosophers and some scientists and some mystics that believe that it is all fluidic in its basic nature, and that what are called particles that go around nuclei are really nothing but vortices within the fluidic ether itself. And depending on the kind of spiral that it is, the tightness of the spiral, the size of the spiral, that determines the nature of the particle. You know, like it has charm and spin and mass and charge and things like that. That is what determines the nature of a particle within an atom. The physicist John Kelvin felt that way. This seems to be indicated by some modern spiritual philosophers. For example, that Rudolf Steiner claims that all things in the ethers, he thinks that gravity is something like a gigantic suction, that it is a concentration, and the same vacuum that is produced in the world of thought that produces empty, vacuous, archetypal thoughts, that same kind of thing is what produces an eddy or a swirling in the ethers that becomes so definite and distinct that it has the characteristics of a particle as seen without sufficient discrimination. So this is not all official Rosicrucian philosophy, but it gives you something of an idea of how formations are in the ethers. The important thing about what we're saying is that the ethers, one general characteristic of them is that they are all very fluidic. A second characteristic is that they are all a medium of transport. They transport conceptions that have come from the spirit through the higher vehicles out into the external world, so that they carry the forms right into existence. There's one other general characteristic about the ethers that is extremely important, and that is polarity. The more we enter into materiality from the inner spiritual worlds, the more things become separate, the more they become discrete, and the more they become outward. In this dense physical world that is our quarantine and our prison, because we have sinned and fallen, and we have lost the Garden of Eden with its four streams, the four ethers that we could see with the etheric vision, because we've lost that, in our quarantine, we can only see the outside of an object. And we can only see it from one perspective at a time. And that is necessary. If we were dumb enough to fall the way we were, the way we did, we have to be treated like very simple kids. And so that the limitations of this world bring about a very indubitable objectivity. This is all of the dense physical world is a great big Missouri. It's a show me state. Everything has to be tested. Everything has to be measured. Everything has to be proven. This dense physical world, the way we look at it, is indubitable. I have walked into lamp poles three different times in life, and the density of the physical world to me is very indubitable. Besides that, this world is simple in other ways. For example, we look at a little brook and it runs downhill, but we wouldn't say that the brook is polarized just because everything runs in one direction. Similarly, we wouldn't say that any stick of wood is polar, even though it has two ends on it. However, if it is something like a bar magnet, we say it is indeed polar. The physicist would say that it is due to the fact that all of the atoms in the iron are pointing in one direction and those atoms are polarized. But that doesn't say very much. That's just saying that there are some things, such as iron or dysprosium or something like that, that have something within them that is or can be polarized. An occultist or a spiritual scientist would be much more specific and would say that it is the polarized etheric atoms and a flux that goes through them that maintains that polarization that is what produces the attraction and repulsion. The physical states themselves are inert, and they're not polarized, but the energy that goes through them is polarized. The dense physical state, especially the solid state, is sort of inert. It's stubborn. The consciousness in the mineral kingdom is it's just been taken out of the universal spirit and it has been thrust into matter and it has lost that, and the only quality that it seems to have is resistance, which is the basic purpose for this world of existence altogether. If the physical plane didn't have resistance, our bodies would fall apart into a puddle or they'd be suspended in the air. So that is what this kind of purpose is here. What the purpose of this state here is all about. The ethers, on the other hand, their purpose is more active. It's more vital. And in the ethers, one experiences vital life that changes and moves things and grows things or causes changes of state. Now yesterday when we looked at the general relationship to the cosmos or the general nature of the cosmos, we looked at the great spirit matter pole. And as far as we can see, The one end of the pole has the solids. The other end of the pole, as far as our experience goes, is divine spirit. This is called the spirit matter world, spirit matter pole. The more you go in one direction, the more things become material. The more you go in the other direction, the more subtle things become, and the more spiritual they are. When we get to the realms of pure spirit, where we left off last evening, the divine spirit and the life spirit, it is just the opposite of the way things are in the chemical region of the physical plane. We just said all we can see here are exteriors. In the life spirit, or everyone who's ever reported in the life spirit, everything in the life spirit, everything is within. There is no without. If there is a without, it's just within that spiritual state. So most of the cosmos, the primary characteristic of it is a withinness. And each inner state has a quality and a character of its own. The more one goes in the direction of matter, the more there is a withoutness. In the spiritual realms, from the region of the human spirit on up into the spiritual realms, there really everything is formally indefinite. There are not forms in the same way like there is the form of this stand, but everything from the world of concrete thought down is in discrete forms. Now, the ethers stand in between the realms that are more inward than outward. And they have a foot on both sides of the stream. They have an inner side and they have an outer side. And that is the function of the ethers. One of the primary functions of the ethers is to take things from the inner spiritual world and externalize them. And externalize them in such a way that they can be seen as separate states of being, as forms externalized that can be objectified and clearly recognized in a way that you can't doubt what you are experiencing. This is probably the reason why the ethers are polarized. One pole of the ethers has the character of the vital spiritual life. The other pole has a depositing or a residualizing quality into the outer worlds. In fact, there are some schools of spiritual thought that think that this is all that the ethers are for, and that all that the vital body is for. They think it's just transitional while we're stuck here in these realms of illusion. That's a very dangerous philosophy to maintain, because if you don't develop the soul body within the ethers, when this isn't here, you'll find out that the ethers are much more than just a carrier, something that carries things from one state to another. Even the ethers themselves, in their functionality, are polarized. The chemical and the life ethers work almost exclusively with building and maintaining material forms. Whereas the two higher ethers, which are called soul ethers, which are what the talks are primarily about, are more associated with the inner worlds, with the desire world, with the world of thought, and so on. So we have then, on one hand, the ethers polarized, each ether being polarized, and the ethers themselves being polarized between the biological ethers and the soul ethers. Let's see. We've got now, I'm going to skip some things here because we don't want this to be too long. Because we've got some of the general characteristics of the ethers. Fluidity, medium of transport, and polarity. Now let's very quickly just introduce a little bit about each of the four ethers, and then tomorrow we start with the really practical thing. We'll work from the bottom up. Chemical ether. This is roughly what corresponds to the word energy in physical science. It's not a really good description because it's pretty sloppy. It would be nice to say that the chemical ether is the subject of what physics calls electromagnetism, but it just doesn't work that way. There are just too many things that don't fit right. And then we get into that tangled web of material science again. Chemical ether is, in its polarity, the force that holds things together, be they atoms, be they compounds. The particulate matter of the solids, liquids, and gases is held together by an interpenetration of chemical ether. The chemical ether, in its polarization, is also what binds the atoms into chemical compounds and which breaks those bindings accordingly, whether energy is applied or energy is removed. That is to say, whether the etheric energy becomes more charged or uncharged, but that's a tough word to use because of the way physics uses it. It produces stable etheric atoms, which interpenetrate stable physical atoms. Now, this is a subject that really requires clairvoyance to understand it, because you can't learn it completely from physics and chemistry alone. It's a mystery, and it's a wondrous mystery. If you take that there's just the particles of stuff, the particles of cosmic root substance, and one common ether, that is the chemical ether, how all of the simple particles, which are all the same, can produce the panoply of elements. Each element has its own character. You know, they have different colors, they're differently reactive and things like that. And it's just the way the formation is made of the living, vital, energetic flow in the chemical ether, how that holds particles in suspension, makes all the differences of everything that we see in the world. That's really a mystery. And it's just formation that does that. There isn't in cosmic root substance an iron or a bromine or helium or something like that. That's something that is the product of particulate matter and chemical ether. The chemical ether, because it is polar, is subject to a kind of magnetism that's somewhat congruent with what is called electromagnetism. And like electromagnetism, it has its spectrum of waves and various energies. The lowest energy that we experience is when the ether is going from the organized state as it was created by the universal spirit back into chaos, when it's been used up and spent. And that is heat. That's our most elementary experience of the chemical ether. Now, it isn't described real accurately in the Rosicrucian literature, but it does appear that the even mechanical ether has within it a flux or a flow. The flux or flow that those atoms spin in on all those spirals that we that everybody's been looking at. So there is that fluidic character, that the strength or the holding ability of the chemical ether is replenished from the spirit continuously. Obviously for us it's from sunlight. Everything in our existence comes from sunlight. So physics and mysticism are the same in saying that things start with chaos and end with chaos, and that when the organized spiritual intelligence becomes disorganized, it goes from a state of higher energy or a state of higher being to a lower being until it's completely lost, which is basically what the second law of thermodynamics says. There's complete agreement there. But that isn't the end of what the chemical ether does. In the vital bodies of plants and animals and humans, it has been specialized by the individual or by the collective spirit that is working in it, so that the atoms and compounds and molecules and cells are held together by the same chemical ether that is in inorganic chemistry. The formation is produced by the creative spirit in thought, but when it gets to the chemical ether, it is the function of the chemical ether to maintain the form, to attract and repulse the different elements in the body that is going to exist in the chemical region of the physical plane. Now, this is from spiritual science. This is done, you don't say that you know about matter until you can prove it to yourself. Humanity in general, we talked about that last evening, could prove that it was above matter when it could take matter and turn it into energy, like in a thermonuclear reaction. For the spiritual scientist, one cannot say that they know what the material world is like unless they can prove it. Someone who is an initiate, somebody who knows the nature of the ethers and has the power to control, could make this stand disappear. Could, by an act of conscious intelligence, take the matrix out of the stuff and allow it to reappear over here. So the statement is that if you know what you're doing, we are foci of the same universal spirit that creates the earth and everything that is in it, and when we are indeed true creators, we can metamorphize the forms and shapes and stuff of this world, and that is the proof of the pudding that is in the eating. Purely mineral part of the chemical region of the physical plane, boy, this is always worth all the time, otherwise you're not quite sure. All of the chemical reactions happen very fast. Most chemical reactions happen zip, 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 and they last very long. However, when there is an organism that has built the form, organic chemical interactions happen very slowly. They happen slowly, there are a few exceptions, but those are, in most cases, the exceptions are the solutions are mostly highly ionic. When those happen. I don't know how technical I want to be here. This is very hard for me to do. Living forms are very supple and they're very soft. But But that doesn't mean they're weak, because we have the example of chemical and light ether having enormous strength even though it's subtle. Back in the 50s, Life magazine had an example with Kirger. Somebody happened to notice a parking lot, a new parking lot, that had between 4 and 6 inches of asphalt, and noticed a crack on it one day, and took a photograph every day. First there was one crack, and then there were cross-cracked, and then it started lifting up, and pretty soon, between 4 and 6 inches of asphalt were pushed aside, and there a few little mushrooms came out. So that even if you're dealing with something that is very subtle and apparently very weak, that's not the case. It's really quite a powerful thing. So most of the organic things are supple and soft. Like you might think the tree isn't supple and soft, but the tree is the live part of the tree where the chemical interactions are taking place are not in the wood, it's in the inner bark and in the leaves, and they're always supple and soft. Let's start looking a little bit at the life ether before this gets too long. Anything that has life ether, either in a vital body or not, in fact, most of the life ether that is outside of the vital body is gobbled up by the life ether in a vital body, and it is used for that purpose. Plants which have only a vital body must grow and live and change. As long as they're living, they're growing. This is the function of the life ether. The life ether is to give life. And life is, you might say, epitomized in the plant. It's something that vegetates, purely vegetates. It doesn't have desires like animals or humans, and it doesn't just subsist the way the minerals do. It is the epitome of life. And so anything that has a vital body has to live. And animals and humans have desire bodies. And when the desire bodies come into play at what is called sexual maturity, the physical body more or less stops growing. But it doesn't stop changing. It changes so that you look at someone every 10 years or every 5 years, take a photograph of the physical body, you'll see that it's constantly in a state of change. So that the life ether of the vital body, if it can't grow, it changes. And what it does, it maintains the physical body. Because once desire is there, desire wants to change things, it wants to move, and that causes wear and tear. Whereas the vital body sustains it, repairs it, and keeps the body going again. Now, material science does not recognize life ether, just like they don't recognize any of the other ethers except by their own names. They dismiss it. If you look in a botany book or a biology book or something like that, they dismiss it in one sentence and say there is no such thing as vitalism. But nonetheless, they can't explain everything with purely material and chemical things. And right now, it's things are beginning to change because of a scientist in England named Rupert Sheldrake has demonstrated that there are fields of what he calls morphogenic fields, which is what we would call the vital body, and that the size and shape of a plant is determined before the plant comes to maturity, and he has very sensitive, subtle electronic devices that he can measure the changes from the field going into producing the plant. This has caused a huge, big uproar because his experiments have been duplicated, but it isn't clear to science that he has been proven or disproven. If you'd like to make $1 million, all you have to do is make a repeatable experiment that proves or disproves that there is a vital body,
or you use that term, you'd have to use the morphogenic field. And if you can do that, somebody has a $1 million prize out there for anybody who can prove or disprove that. The vital body is more or less dense. The life ether part of the vital body is more or less dense, depending on the state of organizations. Recently, there was a movie with Sean Penn in called 33 grams, which is the weight of the life and chemical ether in the human body. What?
23.
23, all right. Stand corrected. Maybe I have a denser. at this point, there would be a lot of people who would be willing to believe I'm a little denser than most. But it was an experiment by Dr. McDougall of Harvard University. It's an experiment that has never been disproven that at death, the body weighs 23 grams less than it did during life. And what was lost was not a solid, a liquid, or a gas, because you can do this in a vacuum, and there are no other things that you can pick up there. The life ether part of a vital body that lives and takes care of the physical body is an exact replica for the physical body itself, with one exception. It's polarized differently. It is to say that males have one outer polarity that is positive, and in the life ether of the vital body, it is polarized negative. Whereas females are outwardly receptive and negative, but inwardly they're positive. And there are all kinds of notes. So the results of this are, obviously, that men have greater surges of strength. But the sustained, slow, vital characteristic of women, they have greater stamina. Women live longer, more women make it through the birth trauma. There are quite a few other things. I just picked up a few of them just in the last few weeks, and I can't remember them now. Should always put them in the notes right away. But at any rate, this is not just an arbitrary difference. This is an absolutely necessary thing. It's necessary for our continuance in this world. Because in order to build the matrix, a life and chemical ether matrix, for somebody to be born into, you have to have a sufficient and positively charged vital stuff in order to do that. Even if it were possible to put a pseudo womb into a man, the results would be disastrous, because the polarization of the male vital body is negative. And you remember the stories of women who lose all their teeth and things like that. It's not just a matter of nutrition. It's that they have given a tremendous amount of their vital body in helping the baby or the becoming human being to build its body, and that is just a huge sacrifice that they make. And if a man would probably be disabled for life, because all of his vital body would go into producing that new body if it could even be done. All right, I'm going to skip some things here, because otherwise it's going to be way too long. And I'm trying to keep these within an hour. I can see I'm not going to quite make it tonight. We've mentioned earlier that the two higher ethers, the light ether and the reflecting ethers, are called soul ethers, and they're different from the biological ethers. Our treatment of them in the next few minutes is going to be very light and very superficial, because for the next two nights we're going to talk about them in ways that we use them every day in detail. They're called soul ethers for several reasons. They're called soul ethers because they're much more closely related to the higher vehicles, to the more soulful vehicles, that is everything from the physical body to the spirit. their interplay with the higher vehicles, they work much more with spiritual consciousness and with character, and much less with form. And the forms are very evanescent in their construction. They're also called soul ethers because their nature relative to the biological ethers is immortal. There is no limit to how much you can have of the soul ethers. And whereas the biological ethers of the dense and vital bodies, they deteriorate after death. The soul ethers do not. They last, they abide for millions and millions of years. And they're called soul ethers because in their longevity, they carry the essence or the soul of experience from the spirit right into the outer world. Now they do have some biological functions, like the light ether has functions biological, like in the vital bodies of plants, there's very little light ether. The negative poles are like the dense physical matter at the bottom of the spirit matter pole. It's passive and receptive and resistant. That is its nature. So the negative pole of the light ether is to receive some light and to help to deposit the life ether through the chlorophyll into the body. It has to do with coloration. The relationship of pure light through coloration, which is a segment of light, and bringing that into vital life into the world. If it worked for the light ether in plants, human beings and animals would have a very difficult time existing at all in this plane, because we have sacrificed temporarily the ability to take sunlight. We've sacrificed it in order to be able to think and be able to desire. We can't live by sunlight alone. Eventually we will regain that at a much higher level. In fact, we work at that every week. When we do the healing service, we are drawing straight from the life spirit, and we're trying to transmute that into healing energy. We're trying to transduce it from that very high level, and that is again taking not just the external sunlight and putting it into usable life energy. It is taking the spirit that is behind sunlight and making it into usable energy. But at any rate, right now, we need the service of the plant kingdom, and the service of the plant kingdom is to specialize life ether in a form that holds together so that we can take it into our vital bodies and be sustained by that. The negative pole of the light ether is also instrumental in the deposit of color in the genitalia of plants, that is, in the petals and things like that. Even in areas close to there, like in the case of plants that don't have flowers but have bracts, the coloration is in the bracts. Can't tell you all about that, how coloration is different in bracts than in petals. The positive pole of the light ether, when it is activated by the flux from the sun, it's responsible for circulating the sap in trees and plants. Spiritual science claims that it is the angle of sunlight that is responsible for the circulation of the plant fluids. In fact, even in animals who have not developed an internal warm blood, the blood in cold-blooded animals is driven by the negative pole, by the positive pole of the light ether, which is why, like reptiles, for example, have to lie in the sun and be driven, have their blood driven by this. Now, this is peculiar, and somebody could object to this because there are experiments that indicate that heat is a major factor in the rise of the Sabbath. I really don't think that there is a contradiction, because the heat, when it strikes things, the light, when it strikes things, gets broken down into heat, and no doubt that thins the sap. But there's probably two factors, one in the light ether and one in the light ether broken down through the chemical ether state as heat. I got all kinds of things here that I'm going to have to pass on. This is way too long. In the vital bodies of animals and humans, the light ether has analogous functions. We've already talked about cold-blooded animals. In warm-blooded animals, the light ether in the bloodstream is what causes the circulation. Now, this is a huge, big difference between spiritual science and physical science. Physical science claims that all the circulation is due to the heart. Spiritual science claims that the blood is driven by the spirit through the light ether, and that it is augmented by the heart, and that the heart is the valve, but that there is a driving that comes from within the blood itself. And this is something that can be verified. In the early stages of the fetus, there is circulation in the fetus, and there is no heart yet. Before there is a heart, there is circulation of blood in the fetus, and it isn't due to capillary action, and it isn't due to osmotic action. It's a pure circulation, and this is done by the light ether element of the blood in itself. The Rosicrucian seers claim that when you live at the poles of the earth in the winter season, when the angle of incidence of sunlight is very large, some mammals can't even produce coloration, so that you have polar bears that are white and you have mink and other animals that turn white. Now, some naturalists say, that's all just camouflage to be able to not stand out in the snow. There would be no argument with that, except that it's something that goes beyond camouflage, because chameleons and a lot of marine animals like octopi and things like that can camouflage without it being, with the same function. I'm very tired. I'm not stating things very well here. In animals and humans, the negative pole of the light ether has an important function. It is responsible for the development of organs, the organs of sense. That is to say that because there is a light ether, and that light ether works into our bodies, we develop a sense of sight in order to see that light. And in the same way that the negative pole of the light ether in a plant develops the chlorophyll, which is just the right color and character to take the light ether and turn it into vital life, in the same way, the negative pole of the light ether in the human organism develops itself to receive the light and produce an organ that can perceive, or at least take the light and turn it into etheric impulses that go along the nerves and into the brain and then into the higher vehicles. Oh boy, where are we here? In the positive pole of the light ether is what is responsible for circulation, the circulation of the blood. It's what drives us, it's what moves us. In animals, the reflecting ether there's very little reflecting ether. And the reflecting ether that there is used in memory. It's primarily dormant, but it is used for memory. Even the anatomy of the physical etheric brain is developed according to the polarity of the negative pole of the reflecting ether, in that memory as it is understood in the brain is pictorial, and that is found in one hemisphere of the brain, whereas the interpretive function of the visual impressions is found in the other hemisphere of the brain, but I didn't know that's way too much. The positive pole, the function of the positive pole of the light ether is, its function is receiving, ramifying, and transmitting thought. The thinking is not done in the physical brain, it's not done in the etheric brain, it is done in the mind, either the individual mind or the collective mind of the group spirit. But in the etheric brain, the negative pole of the reflecting ether takes in the thought impulses straight from the mind, and then it ramifies them. It's possible that you can get into a state, if you learn how to focus into the ethers, or if it happens by accident. It's happened by accident to me several times in life. If you take a nap at a time that you're not used to taking a nap, you don't leave your body quite the same way, or when you come back to it, your focus in the body is not quite the same. And you can get into the negative pole of the reflecting ether, and there are often thoughts that you have thought that have been brought into the reflecting ether that have never come all the way through into the physical, or only a small portion of them has come through. It's like they go off in all directions. One thought may have many, many, many consequences or many different sub-trains that come through from it. And if you can get into that state, you can see that there's much more to your thought than you ever believed possible before. And so it's possible to think in your body. But if you think in your body through the physical brain and the etheric brain, the stress of bringing the thoughts through all the way through without the etheric brain just being a transmitter, but due to the thinking right in the body, kills brain cells. And students of spiritual schools are taught to do their thinking out of the body, or at least to focus into the reflecting ether and do the thinking there, and then just use the etheric brain in its relationship to the physical brain to transmit the thought, which is much less wear and tear on the nervous system, because the nerve tissue does not regenerate easy. It takes a long time, and you have to be extremely healthy. So the function of the function of the reflecting ether is to take thought and to transmit it into the rest of the etheric physical body. The negative pole of the reflecting ether is to receive images. We're going to talk a lot about this in the next couple of days, and it will be much clearer that I tried to do too much in this talk tonight, and I'm sorry for that, and it ends up being something of a jumble. But the negative pole of the reflecting ether has a memory that is almost perfect. It is a memory that is something like what psychologists call an eidetic memory, and what in street language is called photographic memory. That not only are images there, but the images have other characteristics of everything that's in the atmosphere. if there's an attitude saying, like, when is this guy ever going to get done with this talk, that's impressed in the images of the reflecting ether. The peculiarity of the reflecting ether, not only in specialization, more in one hemisphere for one pole and more in the other hemisphere for the other pole, there's another peculiarity about the reflecting ether, and I don't know why. I have a hunch that it has something to do with the positive pole being so connected to the mind that it causes a separation of consciousness such that the negative pole is much more passive and much more associated with the bodies. But the thing of it is that people who do a lot of focus in either the positive or negative pole of the reflecting ether become specialists, more in that pole than in the other. For example, there are books that you can get, I'm sure you can probably get it right here at the library. You know, a nemonist. A nemonist is a person who has a remarkable memory. And there are nemonists that you can give them a page or two of a phone book and have them look at it for 2 or 3 minutes and then ask them to repeat the names. And they can stand there or sit there, and they can name one name after another and another. And there's a really good biography of a nemonist, Jeff, who's going to be giving talks tomorrow and Thursday, probably remembers the name of that book. The man says, well, it's like this. When I recall the names, I'm seeing myself walk down the street, and there in living letters on the mailboxes are the names of all the people. Very pictorial. But the thing of it is that the more of you are of a nemonist, the less you have access to the positive pole of the reflecting ether. So that people who are like mathematicians, who think out all the different possibilities that one theorem means and all the different ways you can prove that same theorem, most people dislike using memory, especially pictorial memory. A lot of scientists, there was a professor of physics at this university that used to teach physiological physics, and he thought that when you had images in your inner consciousness, that that was just static in the brain. He's never worked on any kind of imagination exercise. So what we're talking about then is this very specialized polarization. All right, we have very briefly looked at the four ethers. We've looked at them in such a way that I hope you can get a few ideas that you can think on them and you can see other things in the world and try to understand some of the principles that run through the etheric world, because the more that you can inductively or deductively pick up from the principles that go through, you can, even without etheric vision, you can start using the ethers to your advantage and understand the world much better and function in it much better. And that's what this talk was intended to do, but it wasn't very successful with that. So we'll just call it a day by closing the Rosicrucian prayer. Oh God, increase our love for you, so that we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Are you up for singing?
A little.
All right. Is anybody up for singing? Because we haven't done it for years, and we've got somebody here that will play the guitar. I have a guitar that's...
Mm-hmm.